again, and welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin along with Bob Bupka. Bob, as we record this on November 15th, 2022, for those who played for the Miami Dolphins and fans of the Miami Dolphins, it is now 50 years and counting as the Dolphins from 1972 remain the last unbeaten NFL team for a complete year. Last night, that all happened because of all teams. The Washington Commanders knocked off the previously unbeaten Philadelphia Eagles on Monday Night Football, and the Eagles now 8-1, Washington in the playoff hunt, and the 72 Dolphins can raise the champagne glass once again.
Yeah, they certainly can, and it was kind of amazing because I think it's the first time that a double-digit underdog went on to win the game outright. So congratulations to the Commanders. They played brilliant football and certainly deserved that win over the Eagles. What about what happened in Germany on Sunday? The reception, the excitement, everything surrounding that football game. Do you think, Kelly, maybe one day we'll have a team in Munich, Germany?
It will happen one day. They are now, the National Football League has indicated that it's looking at opportunities in Spain in terms of at least one-off regular season games and in France. Yeah, Bob, it's a great product, and certainly having Tom Brady as your star player in that game on Sunday brought, what were there, apparently 3 million requests for tickets. Sure, the NFL, the product itself is a great product. The games, by and large, are you know, if not down to the last minute, they're close, they're competitive, there's a pace to them, and it's resonating in Europe. There's no question. This was the first game in Germany. I think they have a contract to do, what, three more seasons. Yeah, I don't know how long it'll be, Bob, when and if it happens. I do think you'll see a team. Either it's in London, it's in Munich. Maybe there are two teams in Europe at some point, and as the NFL continues to expand.
Well, I tell you, the NFL and its popularity, not only in the United States, but as you alluded to, overseas, it really is shining. Speaking of shining, how about Jeff Saturday winning his debut over the Raiders?
How about Bob Bupka telling Kelly Elbin last week that maybe it's a good thing that the Colts gave Jeff Saturday an opportunity, a guy who had previously not coached in the NFL, hadn't even been a college coach. Clearly the players rallied around Saturday. He's a good man, and they played well. Matt Ryan returned and was very effective. It was effective enough for the Colts to win. And Bob, they played against a Raiders team that under Josh McDaniels right now just kind of seems to be lost. There are issues there in Las Vegas with that organization. I don't know if Josh, I think he'll survive the season, but the way it's going, I'm not sure he gets beyond 1 year. Now, the Eagles, who we talked about earlier, they next week play the Colts, and it'll be interesting to see if Jeff Saturday can keep that momentum going. But it really nice win for them, and we'll see if this model works. You told me, hey, give this guy a chance, and at least for now, Jeff Saturday is 1-0 as an NFL head coach.
Yeah, good point. He's never lost coaching, so we'll see how long that lasts. How about the great first season for Brian Kelly that he's having at LSU, surprising me, and Sonny Dykes working wonders at TCU. I still, for the life of me, couldn't figure out why TCU was the underdog to University of Texas on Saturday. TCU is mighty tough.
Yeah, they are. They were the underdog because the game was in Austin, and maybe because, you know, TCU is just doesn't quite get the respect that it probably now has in winning a real kind of defensive slugfest over the Longhorns. But first to Brian Kelly and what he's done at LSU. I think a lot of people had a good laugh at Brian Kelly when he made that move from Notre Dame down to LSU and tried to put on a Cajun accent and did a few goofy things. But you know what? The players have played for him. He's got talented players. He's a very good coach. They knocked off Alabama. They've now won the SEC West. They'll be the representative for the SEC West in the SEC championship game in Atlanta next month. They're very much at right now, certainly a team that looks to be ready to play in the Final Four for the college football playoff. TCU. Yeah, Bob, as with anything else, look, you know this. When you win, it's like winning a golf tournament, right? When you win, you gain confidence. When you're TCU and you knock off Texas and you just keep finding ways to win, it just breeds more confidence and more success.
Yeah, you're right about that. We'll see how long that lasts. Anyway, you're a huge college basketball fan.
I am.
And we certainly enjoyed our conversation with Joe Lunardi. But before we get to that, who do you think is the top team in college basketball right now?
Hard to say. I think, you know, Kentucky's going to be really good. Duke, even with John Shire, his first year at Duke, he's replacing a legend in Coach K. Hard to say. It's just early, you know? It's so early in it. And that's what was fascinating in talking to Joe Lunardi, who's our guest today. Joe, longtime PR marketing guy at St. Joseph's University outside of Philadelphia, where he went to school. He got involved in picking these, trying to determine who were going to be these teams to get into the NCAA tournament, and ultimately came up with this bracketology that has really, you know, it put him on the map. And there's, Bob, there's such a passion for college basketball, such a passion for the NCAA men's basketball tournament. And he's, you know, taking advantage of that. I failed to mention a couple of teams. I mentioned Duke, but North Carolina right now is the, not preseason, season's just started. Carolina was so close to winning it all last year, losing to Kansas in the national championship game. But Kansas, North Carolina is really good. Gonzaga's really good. I feel like Mark Few with Gonzaga, at some point, for God's sake, it's got to be his time to win the national championship. But as you'll hear from Lunardi, and with Jim Nance, a Houston grad, wouldn't it be something if the University of Houston, which is among the top five teams right now in the nation, were to win the national championship game in Houston in March in what would be Jim Nance's last Final Four call? Talk about bringing it all together, huh?
That'd be a Cinderella story to say the least. But Joe Lunardi was fascinating to listen to. I know our listeners of Musings are going to really enjoy that.
And they're going to enjoy it right after we hear from our good friends at Titleist.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, much like Mel Kiper Jr. of ESPN, forever changed the interest and passion for the NFL draft. Our guest today has done much the same for the NCAA men's basketball tournament through the invention of bracketology. He is a proud Hawk from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, and he's with us today as another college basketball season tips off. Joe Lunardi, great to have you. Welcome to Musings on Sports.
Well, I'm honored to be on. Always great to talk college basketball. Always sad to put the golf clubs away when the season starts, but it'd be probably hard to find two better hobbies than bracketology and trying to break 90. I have a modest success, or I should say occasional success at each.
Love it.
Hey, Joe, welcome to Musings on Sports. I just want to tell you that I am a huge bettor of college basketball, and I must admit I select some of my selections based on your bracketology. So thank you in advance.
Well, you're welcome, Bob. Of course, you know, there's no gambling at Bushwood, so I don't have anything to do with any of that. But you know, I know Houston is home for you, and I saw those Houston Cougars on Friday of last week in the Veterans Classic at the U.S. Naval Academy against my Hawks, and they looked every bit the number three team in the country, which I think is where they landed in the polls that came out about an hour ago as we record this. And, you know, what a story it would be to, you know, play in a Final Four in Houston in April. That would just be fabulous.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm hoping that it materializes.
But in fairness, Houston's had plenty of championships lately, as my Phillies would attest.
Hey, Joe, you have everything to be proud of. The Phillies pushed them as far as they could. They just ran into some hot pitching arms, that's all.
Yeah, and I was fortunate enough. I share some seats with some buddies here in Philly. And the way it works is we get one game in each round, generally, when the Phillies go to the playoffs. And we got the clincher against the Braves. We got the pennant clincher against the Padres and Bryce Harper's home run. And then my World Series game was not the no-hitter, but the night before when the Phillies hit five home runs. Now, maybe had they spaced them out across the series, it might have lasted a little longer.
Well, maybe you were the good luck charm. They should have had you there for more of the games. Joe, let me ask you this. How did you get started picking your brackets before the internet took over?
Yeah, and it was before the internet. Not too much before, Bob, but I think back to my undergraduate days at St. Joe's in the 80s. And you know, one year we got into the tournament, 1981. It was played in an 8-9 game at a time when the top four seeds in each region got a bye. The field was only 48 teams deep at that stage of its history. It didn't go 64 until 1985. So this was, you know, 4 years before that. But, you know, we won our 8-9 game against Creighton and came up against the number one seed and the number one overall seed, number one ranked team, DePaul that year. Ray Meyer, Mark Aguirre, Terry Cummings, et cetera. Yeah. And really, in fairness, had no business being in the game with them, you know. Two or three pros, a Hall of Famer in Aguirre, undefeated. And, you know, the NCAA tournament being what it is, the Hawks win at the buzzer 49-48, you know, which would be a halftime score these days. But no three, no shot clock then. And I think at that moment, I just fell in love, not only with the NCAA tournament, which appeals to so many of us, especially at that time of the year, even casual fans, but more of a fascination, but in how it's put together, right? Like, you know, why were we, St. Joe's, in what was then the Mideast region, not at home? You know, how did it come to be that we're in an 8-9 game? Because without that, there's no opportunity to even be paired with, much less upset, the number one team in the country, right? And it's the kind of memory that stays with you for the 40 years since. Sure. And you know, just started to meet and talk to people. You grow up following college basketball in Philadelphia. It means, you know, you cut your teeth with the Big Five and the Palestra. And at that time, you know, Villanova, Penn, Temple, St. Joe's, LaSalle all played their games in Penn's arena. The Palestra, which for anybody who goes back in college hoops, you know, it's on their bucket list for good reason. And, you know, as a little Cub reporter for the St. Joe's paper, you know, I had my little season pass. So I'd go see Villanova, Notre Dame and LaSalle Western Kentucky and Penn Princeton when that was everything in the Ivy League. I mean, heck, when I was a freshman in college, Penn, the Ivy League, went to the Final Four. Like this was, you know, obviously I wasn't going to be a great player at, you know, 5'5" or much of a coach. But I aspired to be those big names on press row and, you know, probably without knowing it at the time, kind of had the skill set to be in sports media. And that kind of combined with loving the tournament, then, you know, landing a job covering the Big Five for one of the suburban dailies here in the Philly area after college. We always had a team or two or three in the hunt nationally in a given year. And that, you know, by definition involved kind of speculating on where those teams would go in the tournament. And that's kind of where it started for me. Bracketology as its own entity was more of an accident. I'd like to say there was a great plan for it and a vision to be, you know, in this position today, but nobody could have seen that far ahead, and anybody will tell you I'm not that smart.
You certainly know what you've been doing for a long time with Bracketology. Joe Lunardi, the author of Bracketology, March Madness, College Basketball, and the Creation of a National Obsession, is with us on Musings on Sports. Hey, Joe, I read that within the first 90 minutes of the very first NCAA bracket that you posted on ESPN.com, there were something like 250,000 hits. How did the, once the internet became what it is now, how did that relationship begin with ESPN?
You know, I suppose if I was smarter and you know, more attuned to the business of business, if you will, maybe I should have been more of in a negotiating position at that point in time. We right. had been doing some brackets on the old ESPN.com site, which was called Sports Zone or Sports Wave or something. But yeah, what you're referring to was in January of 2002, you know, Bracketology got its own dedicated page for the first time. And it got promoted, you know, throughout the site. You didn't have to, you know, go 17 clicks deep to find out where Iowa State was listed, let's say. And that night, when its own page was launched, you know, the first Monday in January after college football's over and when college basketball takes center stage a bit, you know, we just, I remember my .com editor and I went up to Bristol for it, and we're just kind of looking at each other thinking, this is nuts. We know that it's popular, but I mean, are there this many people that really care 2.5 months ahead of time what the bracket's going to be?
So you really didn't see that. You really didn't see it coming, right?
Well, not at that level, certainly. You know, I knew from, well, listen to this, you know, before mass cell phones and texting and social media, I knew from the emails that I would get and the live chats that I would do on the site that it was popular. But, you know, I think it was that night that I truly learned that fan is short for fanatic. And particularly in certain parts of the country where college basketball rules maybe year round, you know, it's a religion. It may not be to the same extent as, say, SEC football. But you know, in Lexington or Bloomington, Indiana, or, you know, the Tobacco Road, et cetera, in the basketball, primarily basketball or basketball only parts of the country, you know, the NCAA tournament rules the roost. You could argue that, you know, if you add up all the interest in the tournament over its 3 weeks, you know, and it may not be a fair apples to apples comparison, you know, it approaches Super Bowl level status. It's just not all in one, like the Super Bowl is. And, you know, it's never going to command that kind of a rating. But it takes over our sports calendar for a month in March. And it's pretty darn good.
Hey, Joe, to do your job right, I assume you have to watch a lot of college basketball. How many games per season do you attend in person and maybe watch on TV?
Well, maybe it's best, Bob. So 2 years ago, during our worst COVID winter, I went to 3 live games. And, you know, obviously that's below average. I don't know what the number is, but it's more than 3. Maybe it's 103. But what I really do is I'm constantly tracking games. I've got 80 to 100 teams on my radar at any one point in time. Not so much now. We're just getting started here in November. And you know, we're in the non-conference part of the year. Nobody's playing league games yet. The big boy schools generally are not playing road games yet. So, you know, I don't form, you know, etched in stone kinds of opinions. But, you know, in my peak time, January, February, March, I'll be tracking a couple hundred games a week and seeing portions of them and maybe a handful off circle as games I really want to just have that game on at any one time. And it might not even be, you know, the more obvious matchups when number one plays number two or something like that. You know, I'm paying a lot of attention to the quote unquote bubble teams in the mid majors, because those are the teams that are generally in competition for the last few spots in the field. I mean, I think we can be pretty confident that North Carolina, Kansas, Gonzaga, Kentucky, et cetera, they're going to make it, right?
Yeah.
We know that today on November 14th. But we don't know about, you know, let's say North Carolina State or, you know, St. Mary's or, Houston's obviously going to make it this year, but, you know, that level is not always a lock. You know, we know Kentucky's into the SEC, but what about Mississippi State? What happens when a Temple upsets Villanova, as was the case last Friday? What happens when an Oregon goes down and loses at home to an unranked team? Those are the kinds of games that I'm paying more attention to, because somebody's going to be in my ear in February or March asking about that. I don't know when the question's coming, but, you know, I know from experience, having done this for a long time, that the best way for me to be prepared for a month from now is...
That seems like a winning formula to me. By the way, I've been to 11 Final Fours. I think it's the greatest sporting event because it's, you know, the two games are on Saturday, and then you have all day Sunday to celebrate before you go to the finals on Monday. I was in Rupp Arena when Villanova pulled that unbelievable upset. I also was in New Orleans when North Carolina won that game. So college basketball is certainly close to my heart. Have you ever gotten any crazy comment from your fans or coaches that you could share with us?
Well, you know, I'm mindful. We just had it was election day last week, and there was one year. I won't necessarily mention the state without some, you know, prodding, but I'm in my day job at that time, and I pick up the phone, and somebody says, you know, a woman on the line says, "Please hold for the governor." And I go to myself, "The governor of what?" Right? Well, so wouldn't you know, and I since got the sense of this after the fact, because, you know, I think my Q rating has probably climbed a sliver over the years from invisible to, you know, occasionally noteworthy. And but I don't get calls generally from governors, mayors, or anything like that. Well, this governor of this Midwestern state was apparently sitting around the office on a Friday afternoon, like most of us, looking for a reason not to work.
And, you know, my bracket had just come out, and his state school wasn't in it, but his state school's arch rival was, and he wanted to suggest very strongly to me that I was mistaken in my evaluation. So I, you know, kind of gracefully listened for a while, and I said, Governor, I certainly appreciate your input. I assume it's a pretty slow news day there in your state. If you've got time to call me and give me a raft of crap about, you know, and I don't want to mention Iowa by name, but it might have been Iowa or another four-letter state in the Midwest. And, you know, I ended up giving the then governor of Iowa a bit of a lesson in non-conference schedule strength, which I'm sure he was able to pivot into real life.
A lesson well learned.
Well,
there are many, many, many stories like that.
Great stuff. We're in our final few minutes with Joe Lunardi, Mr. Bracketology for ESPN. Hey, Joe, how much influence do you feel like you have when that selection committee makes the 68 picks that puts March Madness together? And also, what's the best you've ever done in terms of correctly selecting all 68 teams in a given year?
I have, you know, hit them all a few times at 64, at 65, and since it's been 68, I average about one miss a year, I think, over the 25 plus years of, you know, 1.2 or something like that. I mean, the truth of the matter is, when you're talking about distinctions between teams, you know, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, like, I can be a lawyer and make a good argument for and against any team.
Uh-huh.
You know, knowing the vocabulary and knowing the criteria and knowing the way people will either defend or denounce a certain team to try and lift their own team's standing, if you will. And I used to think that the committee paid no attention at all. In fact, for a few years in my middle period, if you will, I almost had the hunch that they were more likely to go the other way. Because let's be honest, like, who wants to be sniped at by that? Like, nobody likes the guy in the back of the room who has all the answers to the test. Right? Nobody likes that guy.
Yep.
And professionally, I'm that guy. I didn't necessarily set out to create it. It just kind of happened that way. But I have been told more in recent years by present and past committee members that they do pay attention. Not just to me, but to some of the other guys who do what I do, many of whom are excellent, and really put in the time and might be better at the analytics part of it. I think my strength is probably in understanding the history of the tournament and the history of the committee and how they'll typically react in certain situations. And that's the kind of thing that only comes from longevity.
Sure.
And, right? I mean... And you know, I also have advantage, you know, of having the biggest platform of all the people who are involved in bracketology. I mean, someday I'll stop and they'll get somebody else, but you know, the advantage of being first has certainly carried me further than I ever expected. And I have been told by committee members that they do pay attention, and I take that as kind of a badge of honor in that I'm seen as credible and hopefully as unbiased as possible, because the one thing you have to do to be good at this is to kind of leave your ego at the door. Because when I miss multiple teams, and it does happen, and you know, from time to time, or I'm way off on seeding, it's almost always because I inject my own personal opinion or personal bias,
mm-hmm.
instead of relying on the criteria that I know they're using. Right? My job isn't to vote and project publicly what I would do if I were one of the 10. My job is to get inside their head and tell you what they're going to do. There's 1,000 other analysts on every network who will give you their opinion. I study what they do and the numbers that they have, as well as some of my own that help me aggregate their work and come up with the most accurate forecast possible. So for me, you know, it's a coin flip on those last couple of teams. So I tend to be prouder of seeding and placement and pairings, because that's kind of the deeper dive. That's less luck and more, I just think the harder work of it all. And from the opening night of the season until Selection Sunday, I don't go to bed until all the games are done, which is really a drag when Hawaii goes into overtime at home. It thankfully doesn't happen that often. But I always have a 1 to 68 list ready to go. And because I never know, particularly once we get through the end of college football, I could get a call at any minute to come on and do a segment, or somebody might need a graphic in a production truck, and probably 80% of what I do is off camera, feeding the folks at our network that information.
Yeah, and Joe, so much goes in to the selection committee's decisions for the 68 teams, for everything that you try to predict for the 68 teams. Joe, there's been a whole lot of buzz going on that the number of teams in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, and I suppose the women's as well, is going to increase, with some numbers as high as 96 for the men's that I've heard. Your thoughts on the what sounds like an inevitable increase, is that, in your opinion, is that good for the tournament, bad for the tournament? How do you feel about it?
I think a lot of people probably don't even know when we went and added the first four and went to 68 in 2011, how close we were to 96 at that time. The rights were up for bid. The NCAA wanted to reach a certain revenue number to fund its operations and distributions to membership, and they thought they were going to have to provide a lot more inventory to get to that rights bid. The number that they wanted. As it turned out, at that time, CBS, which was adding Turner to the mix, didn't want a significant amount of new inventory. And the tournaments essentially stayed in its current configuration and footprint of, you know, three weekends with the addition of the first four at the front end, a couple of doubleheaders in Dayton. And my hope is that if and when this happens, and I do believe it's a win, that we will simply add to that set of opening round doubleheaders. We do not need 96 teams to make sure that every school with a legitimate chance to advance is included. I'm not suggesting the following statement means I'm a healthy person, but nobody studies this every day for 4 months like I do. And if I told you who team number 96 was today, and I happened to just, it's North Texas, which last night lost in St. Mary's 63-33. Okay? Like, we don't need that to have a worthy championship event. But I do think the expansion of Division I over the last couple of decades, I mean, we're now up to 363 teams, which is way too many, by the way, but that's another story for another day. There's going to have to be some compromise between the majors and the non-majors as these power leagues expand. Like, they're not going to be content until they're getting, you know, 2/3 of their teams in the field. And the whole idea of finishing in the top 4 or 5 of your league and getting in, if we end up with a Big Ten that has 18 or 20 teams, politically, that's just not going to fly. And I do think that the power conferences are smart enough to realize that they shouldn't mess with the automatic qualifier. And if they're not, CBS and Turner are going to tell them that the Sister Jeans and the Butlers are really good for rings. And they,
because the stories are so good, right?
In the early, right. So I, you know, talk about eliminating some of the AQs. I don't think that's going to happen. How it will be configured and who will have to play in the early rounds to get into the main bracket that'll still start Thursday at noon, I'm not sure. But an expansion to 72 with two versions of the first four, or even 80 with four versions of the first four, one in each region, I think would retain the character of the tournament as it is and allow for the current footprint on the calendar to remain as is. And interestingly, and Bob probably knows this, the date of the Final Four every year in the modern era is dictated by one thing, and that is, when will the azaleas bloom in Augusta?
You're so right, Joe.
CBS has the Masters the week after the Final Four. Augusta tells CBS when it's going to be most beautiful. Everything else just backs up. So, and that is not going to change in our life. So, I think, at least in our lifetime, we're probably going to see the tournament close to the status quo, if not exactly.
Joe, you've been fascinating. I could listen for hours, and you're so right about the Masters calling the shots. Jim Nance is going to be hanging him up after this year's Final Four. But he did share with us, he was a guest on Musings, he shared with us that he's shooting to do 51 Masters. And I said to him, 51 seems like an odd number. He said, well, the reason is, Bob, 51 will mark the 100th anniversary of the Masters, and that's the one I want to hang him up on.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Hey, Joe Lunardi, when you do come back up for air, the three of us will do our best to get together to play a round of golf. In the meantime, thank you for joining us on Musings on Sports, and I know everybody listening and following on ESPN and ESPN.com will be following you and your prognostications. Thanks again for all you've done for bracketology and for college sports and college basketball, Joe.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
You know, Bob, fun talking to Joe. He loves what he does, you know, and I think, like anything else, if you're passionate about what you do, and for him, all the games he's going to be covering and has covered, to be up close and personal, and to, you know, to have a product that people glom onto and are passionate about, good man, and great stuff that he continues to produce.
Yeah, he was extremely interesting to listen to.
Next week, wow. I'm thrilled. Mike Doc Emrick, the legendary hockey announcer who retired from NBC Sports a couple of years ago, will be our guest. I can't wait to talk to Doc, one of the, if not the greatest hockey announcer ever. We're going to be honored to have Doc Emrick as our guest on Musings on Sports. Bob, great being with you again, and look forward to talking to Doc Emrick next week. Hope everybody enjoys this podcast and all of the Musings on Sports podcasts, which you can find anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast.